Trump, tariffs, and the trouble ahead is the name of the talk to be given by Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and former New York Times columnist at the New Marlboro Meeting House. It will explore the political and economic fallout of the second Trump administration, as well as the state of the nation and his career as one of America's most prominent public intellectuals. It'll be a candid and lively discussion led by Ellen Pollack, the business editor at the New York Times. Krugman's event has now sold out, but there are many other upcoming events, including a spectacular weekend on the 23rd and 24th featuring food experts Ruth Reichel and Kevin West. And you can stay tuned to the website, which I'll give at the end of the event, to see if new tickets become available for the Paul Krugman event. Again, Paul Krugman and Ellen Pollack in discussion at the New Marlboro Meeting House on August 30th at 4:30. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Paul Krugman back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you back on the program.
Good to be on.
When you do events like this, especially one where you'll be talking with Ellen, and there's a very, it's a very defined topic of what you're discussing. What is the message that you like to get across, as you know your audience well enough to know that people are concerned, people are worried, dare I say, they're even scared?
Yeah, well, I mean, my goal is mostly to inform. I mean, I'm not there to scare people. I'm not there. Obviously, I have political views, but I'm not there to win people over to those particularly. But I think this is a difficult, you know, this is a very stressful time in a lot of ways. And at least in some areas, maybe I can help people who are interested and willing to think hard to tell them something about what's going on and what we know and also what we don't know.
When it comes to what we know, what do we know about tariffs and the way that this whole program came about? Something we didn't hear a lot about during the campaign, but certainly has been a focal point in the first several months of the administration.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who are out there looking for what is the grand strategy and who is the mastermind behind all of these tariffs and the particular different tariffs on different countries and so on. And the deep, dark secret is that there is no grand strategy and there is no hidden intelligence behind it. This is Donald Trump has a personal obsession with tariffs, goes back decades. It's probably not even shared by very many people in his own party, but nobody wants to cross him. If you try to understand why, you know, why do we have this tariff rate on that country and another tariff rate on another country? It turns out, actually, that when he announced the initial tariffs, that if you asked ChatGPT to devise a set of tariffs that would balance U.S. trade, it came up with that set of tariffs, which was really bad economics. And people said, did we really just have an AI design a tariff program? But what appears to have happened is that ChatGPT had somehow or other scooped up previous writings by Peter Navarro, Trump's trade czar. So really, this is just Navarro's thing. You would be very hard-pressed to find an economist who isn't, in some sense, on Trump's payroll, who will say that any of this makes any sense.
When it comes to making sense, so then, if it's because the way you just described it, it seems like a whim, and it does. It seems much of it seems like a whim, but it with these deadlines, and they come and then they go, and then there's new ones, and then they're extended. I mean, this doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon.
The first thing to understand is that all of this is a violation either of longstanding international agreements or U.S. law, or both. I mean, the trade policy, presidents have a lot of discretion, but not unlimited discretion. And we do have agreements with other countries that were duly signed and passed by Congress. And all of this is in violation of both domestic statutes and the international agreements, which doesn't stop Trump from doing them, but does mean that there's no certainty in the future. Whatever, even if we have a supposed deal or we have an alleged promise, we just broke a whole bunch of promises right with these tariffs. So what is any future promise worth? So all of this creates an environment where really nobody knows. If you ask, what will the tariff rate on European Union products be 2 years from now? Nobody has any idea. And that's not a great look if you're trying to make business plans.
And if you're trying to know what the broader effects are, which I think many are concerned, obviously, about inflation, and how should we look at that?
Well, except under very rare circumstances, tariffs, I mean, the tariffs are directly paid by whoever does the importing, which is usually either a shipping company or the U.S. user. So I mean, tariffs are actually paid by Walmart as the ships are unloaded. And it's conceivable under certain circumstances that foreign companies, to preserve market share, would cut their prices so that U.S. consumers don't end up bearing the tariffs. But that is not happening now. We actually have direct information on what foreign producers are charging for what they sell to the United States, and they have not cut their prices. So ultimately, this ends up being paid by Americans. For now, a lot of it has been absorbed by businesses who have been reluctant to raise prices as long as there was some hope that the tariffs would go away, but that won't last. So in the end, yeah, we're talking about a hit to U.S. consumers something like 1.5 to 2% on consumer prices overall.
You have said that a tariff is basically a selective sales tax. Talk about that selectivity and how those sales taxes fall so much more heavily on people in the bottom, say 30 or 40% of the population.
Okay, the main thing is that a sales tax applies when you buy something, and people with lower incomes, live close to the edge, spend a lot more of their income than people with high income. So if you're living well below your means, which could mean spending $1 million a year, but you have an income of $1.5 million, then you're paying a much smaller fraction of your income in these effectively on the tariffs than somebody who's barely scraping by. There's also, and these are subtler things, but the tariffs apply to goods, not to services, and most of which are domestically produced anyway. And higher income people tend to spend more on services and less on goods, right? If you're towards the bottom if you're in the bottom third of the U.S. population, you spend a lot of your money on food. If you're further up, you spend less on food. And when you do, a lot of it is restaurant meals, where a large part of the price is actually the services provided by the restaurant. So there are other more problematic things where probably if we look at the tariffs, they're probably going to hit low-priced clothing more than they hit, high-end clothing and so on. But overall, it's pretty clear that this is a significantly higher, bigger hit for working class and poor families than it is for the affluent.
Paul Krugman will be in conversation with Alan Pollack at the New Marlborough Meeting House on August 30th at 4:30. The name of the talk, Trump, Tariffs, and the Trouble Ahead. I'm interested in the legality of this. It seems that much of this is illegal, although it also seems as though the courts probably will not do anything about it. And I'm curious as to how that happens.
Well, it's very much the politicization. I mean, a large part of the Trump tariffs, there are various things, but a lot of it was based upon something called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which gives the president broad discretion to impose tariffs given an economic emergency. But since Trump himself says that the economy is great, how can he invoke an emergency at the same time as he says that? And we do have a court that deals with these things. There is a court of international trade, and that court ruled that the whole thing is illegal. But that was put on stay while it was appealed. And the appeals court hasn't ruled yet, but most people following the arguments in that courtroom think that the appeals court will uphold the trade court, but then it will go to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, everyone believes, is just rubber stamps, whatever Trump does. So this is not a situation where the failing is in our institutions, except that institutions consist of people. And if you have people who basically are inclined to give Trump whatever he wants, never mind what the law may say, then the courts are not effective.
The occasional sales pitch on this is that it will ignite American industry. And I'm curious as to how you see that, because it seems so far it has been very limited. And is that going to change anytime soon?
No, it really isn't. For one thing, there are sort of multiple layers of failure in the argument that this is going to be great for American industry. And the first one is that these are tariffs that are, it's not just consumer goods that are being hit. It's also industrial inputs. I mean, we have 50% tariffs on steel and aluminum. So if you're thinking about the U.S. auto industry, what do you make cars out of? So this is actually, yeah, foreigners trying to sell cars in the United States will pay a higher tariff, but U.S. car manufacturers will have much higher costs as a result of the tariffs. So this thing is probably just in a direct sense. If you look at the balance of the of what's being tariffed, it's bad for U.S. manufacturing. Then there's there are follow-on consequences. At a fundamental level, the U.S. trade deficit is not about tariffs. It's not that foreign countries do bad things to us. The Europeans have an average tariff of about 1% on U.S. manufactured goods, so that's not what's going on. And even if we could somehow eliminate manufacturing trade deficit, that would only marginally increase the number of manufacturing workers in America. You know, deindustrialization did not happen primarily. The trade deficit plays a role, but deindustrialization is mostly because we got more productive. We can produce the manufactured goods people want with fewer workers. So the idea that we can somehow go back to the nation we were in 1965 by tariffs just doesn't work, and it fails at, you know, three or four different levels.
I mentioned the sales pitch about making American industry stronger. But the rationale initially was that of national security. I've never quite understood that. Give me a sense of how you can make that case.
Well, I mean, we do have, but in this case, both U.S. law and international agreements do have a national security exception. If there's a critical thing that where you really might, in the event of international conflict, be in trouble, if you don't have domestic capacity, then it is allowed to put a tariff on. And so, rare earths, the minerals that are right, critical for technology, a tariff to promote the development of a U.S. rare earths industry would be allowed. Although probably not the most effective way to do it, but that's allowed. There are cases where there are real national security arguments. But the argument that, I mean, we have our tariffs on Canadian aluminum are being justified by a Section 232. Anyway, sorry, there was a lot of jargon in this area, but they invoke national security, and the idea that American security is at risk because some of our aluminum is being smelted in Canada, that's crazy. There are valid, national security is a valid concern, but to be used, you know, very sparingly, and in this case, it's being used as a blanket justification for practically everything.
So this chaotic period that we are in, you see that as something that can be sustained for a while, a prolonged period.
Oh, certainly as long as Trump is president. Nobody knows what comes next. And I don't know that we can ever get back to where we were. I mean, we have trade agreements that a large part of the reason that you do trade agreements is not the specific tariffs that we get that are agreed on, but the belief that they create some certainty. That we had, we signed the free trade agreements with Canada and Mexico, which were supposed to encourage international trade and investment within North America, because now it was simply the law that you had free access, that the three countries have free access to each other's markets, except now it turns out that only as long as Trump feels like it. And you don't easily go back from that. Even if someone else ends up sitting in the Oval Office, the rest of the world businesses, never mind other countries, businesses will say, well, you know, I don't know what our trade policy is going to be, because we've seen it demonstrated that presidents of the United States feel free to ignore past agreements whenever the mood strikes them.
And that seems frightening.
I mean, there are things that are really frightening which have nothing to do with economics, but this is just this is just bad for business.
Right.
You know, who wants if you want to sink a lot of money into a set of investments, there's, you know, a set of investments that makes sense if we have 10% tariffs will be worthless if we end up having 35% tariffs. And on the other hand, if you make investments based on the belief that we're going to have 35% tariffs, but they go back to 10, then those investments are a waste. So there's a really strong incentive to just plain pile up cash and sit on your hands. Why stick your neck out when you have no idea what future policy is going to be?
Given your writing on these issues and that you retired from your position as an opinion writer at the New York Times, do you miss that? Was that good timing or bad timing?
Oh, I think the timing was actually very good. The Times, there were some stuff I was actually feeling that I was being given a lot less freedom to write what I wanted to in my last year at the Times, in any case. But beyond that, if you look at how I'm writing now, there are, first of all, I'm writing more. I'm out there 7 days a week instead of two. I'm able to include charts and a lot more, you know, and occasionally get a bit wonky in ways that understandably I couldn't do in the pages of the New York Times. So given where we are right now, this is the Substack, the online newsletter is just a much better medium for what I want to do.
When you say you felt somewhat limited in your last year at the Times, was that a general feeling amongst columnists?
I don't know. I mean, you probably think that all New York Times columnists are all having lunch together every day, and that's was not at all the case, right?
Algonquin roundtable kind of thing. You don't have that?
Yeah. No, I never had an office at the Times. And quite a few of the columnists I never met in my life. And I don't really have a sense of how other people were feeling. All I can say is that I was feeling very much that I was spending as much time arguing to put stuff back in that the editors had taken out as I was writing the column itself.
Do you have a sense for what the reason was for that?
No, I mean, I have.
Yeah.
Groundless speculation, but just just generally, there's a kind of the Times still, well, the media in general often strive for a kind of balance and even-handed feel, even when the situation is not balanced and even-handed.
I would say that your last column, you said my last column, finding hope in an age of resentment. And do you still think we can find hope?
There's always hope. I mean, this is very difficult, but a lot of institutions have been very disappointing and have caved. But individuals, there's been people really are standing up. I mean, people who track this stuff say that, you know, there are far more demonstrations now against Trump policies than there were during his first term. If we look at when people do get an opportunity to vote, they're making their displeasure known. And there's just a lot of the outpouring of really just sort of my sort of thing, but of really good analysis of what's happening is amazing. We do see a lot of I do think in the end the country will stand up to this.
Paul Krugman and Alan Pollack will be in discussion at the new Marlboro Meeting House on August 30th at 4:30. You can find out more information by going to nmmeetinghouse.org, nmmeetinghouse.org. Paul Krugman, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Well. Thank you very much. Again, the Paul Krugman event has sold out, but there are many other upcoming events, including a spectacular weekend on August 23rd and 24th featuring food experts Ruth Reichel and Kevin West. You can find out more information about those events and perhaps last-minute ticketing opportunities for Paul Krugman by going to the website nmmeetinghouse.org, nmmeetinghouse.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.